In 1978, when T.J. Parcell was just 17 years old, he did something that wasn't too smart. He held up a store with a toy gun to impress a girl. For that action, he was sent to a Michigan state prison for more than 5 years. When T.J. entered the adult, maximum security prison environment, he was an effeminate, skinny, and naive 17-year-old. Within his first 24 hours in prison, T.J. was gang-raped by several men. Those men then tossed a coin to see which one of them would have him as their boy. For the remainder of his prison term, T.J. remained the property of another prisoner. T.J. survived the prison world, and after getting out, he managed to stay out. Now, 30 years after he went to prison, he has published a book about his experiences inside. The book is called Fish, a memoir of a boy in a man's prison. T.J. Parcell has become an active advocate for human rights inside prisons. He spent several years working with the U.S.-based organization Stop Prisoner Rape, and he is a consultant to the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission. T.J. joins me on the phone from his home in Long Island, New York, to tell us more about his memoir and his experiences. Thanks for joining us, T.J.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
So your book it's very intense, moving, and at sometimes very disturbing, and it must have been very difficult to write this book. Just wondering how you came to a place where you sort of chose to write this book and put your story out there.
Well, as you mentioned, Emily, I got out of prison when I was 21, and I managed not to go back. In fact, I did everything I could to put as much distance between me and that experience as I possibly could. I moved to New York. I put myself through college. I stumbled into the software business at a great time. And, I put together a life. And along the way, of course, my demons caught up with me. And I spent many years in therapy dealing with the issues and the aftermath of my rape and sexual victimization in prison. But for all intents and purposes, if you looked at me from the outside, you'd never guess that I'd been to prison or that I experienced what I did. But what happened was about 5 or 6 years ago, I walked into a Manhattan video store, and up on the monitor was a past episode of Oz, the HBO prison series. And there was a character in this program who was raped and was the victim of forced feminization. And the young men in the video store were looking up at this scene on the television monitor, and they were laughing. And that was a real defining moment for me. I kind of looked at these guys, I looked up at the screen, and I just thought, it's wrong what goes on inside of prisons and what's acceptable, accepted as a fact of life in prison. And that was the moment that I decided to do something about it. And that was when I sat down and I started to write my personal memoir, and that was the time that I started to get involved politically to help change the system.
So, can you tell us a little bit more about your story? How did you end up in prison?
Well, as you also mentioned, it was a very foolish prank on my part. I had robbed a photomat with a toy gun. It was, something that was just intended to be a prank. And a young woman in the booth turned and opened the cash register, and she handed me the money. And in a very impulsive moment, I just, took the money and I ran home. And I got caught. I was one of these kids that always got caught, and I got caught. I was 17 years old under Michigan law at the time. 17 was considered an adult. It didn't matter that the gun that I used was a toy gun. As long as the woman inside that booth perceived the gun to be real, it was considered armed robbery under Michigan law. The judge wanted to make an example out of me. He sentenced me to 4.5 to 15 years. I was sent inside the walls of a close custody prison with men that were mostly in their 30s, men who were serving very long sentences, up to and including life. And I was a skinny kid. I was, completely out of my element. I was frightened, the guys on my very first day offered me a drink of spud juice, a homemade liquor. And they had spiked it with Thorazine, a heavy sedative they gave the mentally ill prisoners. And then they lured me down the hall where I was gang raped.
And what happened to you? What happened to you after that?
Well, it's horrific as the gang rape itself was. My real trauma was what occurred afterwards. The men literally flipped a coin in the air to decide which one of them would own me. And the guy that won the coin toss was an inmate whom I call in my book Fish, Slidestep. And, Slidestep was a man who was serving 15 to 30 for a violent crime. I became his property. I was his kid. And as long as I was at that prison, I, was essentially his property. What I cover in my book is how I survived it. I was very private about what happened naturally when I got out. I was never going to tell anyone what happened. But for many years, I was very private about ever even having gone to prison. But when I did confide in one or two people, they'd always ask the same question. They'd want to know, what was it like and how did I survive the ordeal? And in my book, Fish, basically, I try to answer those two questions. What I had to do to survive in there and, ultimately how I was able to save enough of myself to salvage later.
And part of your story is that while you were in prison, you came out of the closet, and it's entwined with you realizing your sexuality. How did that play a part of your experience and part of the story?
Well, if I may, you mentioned in your introduction that I was an effeminate kid. I actually wasn't an effeminate kid. I was just, I was 17 and I was skinny and I was not very street smart. So, I stuck out a little bit. And the sexuality, or my sexuality, is a major thread in my book because, all kids in late adolescence are dealing with issues of identity and sexuality. And I was forced to come to terms with those things in this world that had very distorted notions of what masculinity, what manhood is. So it's a major thread of my story. I also grew up in a time in the late 1970s where, I grew up in a working class town. There was not a lot of, in fact, there was no representation of gay people in the media. I am a gay man. I came to terms with my sexuality while I was there, and I struggled with my identity through this process because, again, as I mentioned, the definitions or the notions of what manhood is in prison is very distorted. The rapes that occur inside of prison are perpetrated by men who are self-identified heterosexuals both before and after incarceration. They don't view what they're doing as gay sex. As long as they're not the ones that are being penetrated, they view the sexual activity that they're engaging in as, basically men who have been raped or gay men that come into the system, they view them as substitutes for women. Actually, even when they rape someone, they don't even really think of it in terms of rape as you and I and civilized society thinks of it as rape. They kind of view it as, someone who would allow that to happen to them deserve what they got because they weren't men in the first place, because a real man would never allow that to happen to him. And gay men they view as fundamentally lacking in manhood in the first place. And because gay men like it, as they view it, they're entitled to take it whenever they want. It's a very distorted culture of anyone, I think, would have to navigate, but especially for a, 17-year-old kid, it was, quite a horrific encounter.
I imagine has a lot to do with the issues of power, dignity, respect, control, because when people are inside, they're stripped of those things.
Yeah, and I mean, most rape is about power. It's not about sex, but, the sex is an element there as well, because you're talking about you know, at the time, the demographics have shifted a bit here in the United States over the last decade or so with the war on drugs. But back in the late 1970s, the average age of males who were incarcerated was between 25 and 30. You're talking about men who were in their sexual peak. It's an energy that has to go somewhere. And so they viewed inmates that were raped or turned out, or as they call it, or gay, as substitutes. What I try to cover in my book, Fish, is what I explain in my book is the whole power dynamic and the way it works and the roles that people play. One of the ways that I was able to survive my ordeal was, I learned how to use the power of my sexuality to gain some control and in a relationship. You know, as I mentioned, the man that won my coin toss, he was the person I was assigned to. I was his property, and my whole quality of life was tied to this individual. When I went to another prison, when I was transferred to a lower security prison as I got closer to my release date, my reputation came with me. As soon as I hit the yard of that new prison, everyone knew about me from the other prison. So I had a very limited window to, you know, get another man for protection, or I faced, another gang rape, violent scenario. So, you know, you hook up or you lock up you could snitch, but snitching is a very dangerous proposition because all inmates have a vested interest in eliminating snitches. So it's, the weaker inmates are sexually exploited, but snitches are killed inside prisons. And so that wasn't an option for me. So I had to go into something that we call a protective pairing. And the way that, I was able to at least salvage a little bit of, or save a little bit of myself, was to just accept it and work within the power structures that exist there, and try to use my sexuality to gain power.
And another experience that you recount in your book is your relationship with Paul. I was very moved at the end of the book where you published a letter of correspondence between you and Paul 25 years later. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with him and what that meant to you at the time?
Sure. I mean, I think Paul was one of the main reasons I was able to ultimately survive my ordeal there. Paul was my, and was also my first love. Paul was I was 17, Paul was 19 at the time. He was 2 years older than me. He had gone into the system 2 years earlier at my age. He met a similar fate that I did. He was raped when he first arrived. He was forced into these protective pairing scenarios. And in fact, Paul taught me a lot of the ways in which one can survive in there, or attempt to survive. Paul was my first love. He escaped, so he was my first heartbreak as well. When I sat down to write the book, 25 years later, I got on the internet to find out what body of knowledge existed on the topic, see who, if anyone, had written about prisoner rape before. And, sadly, there was not a lot of information out there. And in the course of doing that, I found the Michigan Department of Corrections website, and they have an offender tracking system. And on that, I was able to find Paul. And it even pulled up a digital picture of him. And sadly, he has been in prison all this time. And it broke my heart. I went out to my studio and I just sobbed. And then I wrote him a letter and told him what he meant to me and how he had had an impact on my life. And Paul wrote me back. And, those two letters make up the conclusion of the book. I think that, my book is a story of survival. It is a an expose of the prison system. It's an indictment of the prison system in the United States, I think. And I think those two letters at the end of the book highlight the travesty and the tragedy of the system, and I hope it also highlights the lost opportunity. Because there were some positive things that I personally got out of my experience in prison. I finished high school in prison. I got some college in prison. There was a prison administrator who was a real angel for me. And, you know, I write about her in the book because she hired me to work on the prison newspaper. And she inspired some things in me to, you know, kind of look at myself and acknowledge, you know, how I had been, assuming the role of victim. So, you know, I try to tell some of that in the book as well. You know, the sad reality in the United States is we've got, you know, growing prison populations. We have, appalling recidivism rates. Two-thirds of all prisoners in the United States are rearrested within 3 years of coming out. And 50% are returned to prison on new charges. Sadly, you know, we've eliminated a lot of the programs in the United States that can, you know, train or help prepare inmates for reentry. And so, you know, there was, you know, a lot that I was hope to communicate in my book.
I'm curious what you've learned about punishment, revenge, forgiveness. Both in terms of how society responded to your actions that landed you in jail, and also how you connect that in terms of your response to those people who raped you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I always like to say every time that I talk about this issue that I always like to say that, you know, what I did was wrong. I broke the law. My crime was a serious one. You know, I mean, regardless of what my initial motivations were, you know, it was armed robbery. That is a very serious crime. I deserve to be punished. I might even go so far as to say, you know what, I deserve to go to prison. What I would submit is I didn't deserve what I got when I arrived there. Rape should never be part of the punishment. You know, I was sent to prison as punishment, not for punishment. So, you know, a lot of that is what's motivated me to speak out about this issue, because there is this widespread, you know, acceptance that rape is okay, that rape's just what happens inside a prison, and it doesn't have to be that way. There are many things that can be done that can greatly reduce the likelihood of sexual violence behind bars, and the first and foremost thing that we need to do is to not tolerate it, not accept it. I think that we also have a problem of dehumanizing prisoners. What I try to do in my book is humanize everyone, even my perpetrators, because they all have stories as well. And I think in the process of writing the book and in the process of my therapy, I've had to, come to terms with the complexity of these people that played these roles in my life. And I've had to come to a place of forgiveness. If for nothing else, my own sanity, my own serenity. So when I write about the men that raped me, I try to tell the reader as much as I can about some of the things that I knew that helped inform their decisions. And I think because of that, hopefully one will view my book as a book of redemption.
The intensity of your book stayed with me for a couple days after reading it. What has been the response of people who've read your book? What was their response since I think it was released last year?
Yeah, it was released in late November. I've been pretty busy since then, launching it, and it's won an award from the National Council on Crime and Delinquency. It's got really great reviews in the Los Angeles Times and the New York Post, and recently I got a really great review from Lambda Literary. All of those things are great. I mean, there were people that read it and understood it. They really got what I was trying to do. I think what I enjoy the most is emails that I get from readers who, You know, they all tell me that they couldn't put it down, and which, as a writer, that's very gratifying to hear. But a lot of, most of the responses I get are like yours. You know, people say that they're very moved by the story, and, you know, that's what I wanted to do all along, was to put a human face on this issue and humanize this issue. And I, you know, I think it's what's sadly needed in this area.
So you've ended up being quite active around these issues, worked for a number of years with the organization Stop Prisoner Rape, and you were also worked to pass a bill in the United States called the Prison Rape Elimination Act. Can you tell us a little bit more about that activist work, what it means to you, and what kind of things you were able to accomplish with it?
Sure. My activism has been another part of my healing. I can't tell you how enormously healing it and gratifying it's been for me to be able to talk to policymakers and to participate in some of the activities that brought about the Prison Rape Elimination Act. The Prison Rape Elimination Act was the first ever federal legislation to address prisoner rape. Among other things, what it does is establish a national commission, the Prison Rape Elimination Commission. And what they're doing is they've been studying the problem for the last couple of years, but they'll be issuing federal standards that will affect every federal, state, local prison, jail, juvenile facility, even immigration detention facilities in the United States. This has very far-reaching consequences. It's doing things like mandating classification procedures to make sure that we don't put juveniles with adults, that, to eliminate the possibility that what happened to me doesn't happen to some other 17-year-old. During the course of these activities, there's one moment for me that I'll never forget, and it was when Stop Prisoner Rape organized an event on Capitol Hill where we brought together a number of survivors to speak about their experiences and to speak to lawmakers in support of the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And I stood next to a woman, Linda Bruntmeier. Linda Bruntmeier's 17-year-old son went to a Texas prison for starting a dumpster on fire. And some crazy judge in Texas sent him to prison for 8 years. And while he was in prison, he was violently raped. He begged for protection. He filed formal documented grievances begging for protection. The state did nothing. He hung himself in his jail cell. That is as criminal as any of the activity that has landed many of the people in prisons in the United States. And, for me to stand next to this young boy's mother, you know, as I say, is a moment I'll never forget.
And so what are things like inside today compared to when you were in prison? Has it, you talk a bit about this bill and some things that you hope will change, but I imagine the issue is just as prevalent as it was when you were in prison.
It is just as prevalent as it was when I was in prison, and I think in a lot of ways it's worse than when I was there, because gangs have become such a dominant culture, a dominant part of prison culture. And gangs will rape, and they control a sexual trade inside of prison. They will force younger, vulnerable inmates who have been raped into prostitution. They'll force them into performing sexual acts for, $5 and $10. At Stop Prisoner Rape, we received numerous complaints from the state of Texas and from California, and many examples of cases where, again, highly documented cases of complaints that went unanswered by prison administrators. I didn't suffer abuse at the hands of prison gangs. And frankly, I don't know that I would have been able to survive that. There was a highly publicized case last year in Texas of a young gay African-American who filed seven formal grievances begging for protection, and it wasn't until the ACLU filed a lawsuit on his behalf before the Texas officials were moved to remove him from the situation. That just, you know, should never go on. So that's one of the things that, you know, I and others are continuing to, you know, fight for change in those areas. I think that, you know, again, the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission offers, I think, you know, a lot of promise in this area in terms of mandating standards under which these states will be held accountable, or they'll risk losing federal funding, which can be significant.
And for you, what are you doing now? Are you working on another book, or?
Yeah, I'm actually working on my second book, which is somewhat of a sequel to Fish. You know, Fish ends when I get out of prison, and you know, the epilogue, you know, sort of briefly tells the readers what you know, what happened to Paul, what happened to me. In my next book, I'm writing about the aftermath and how I went from there to here, dealing with the lingering aftermath of my experience in prison, and how I was ultimately able to transcend those circumstances and build a life for myself.
So when will be able to expect that, do you think?
Well,
depends how many hours you spend in your studio every day.
Depends on how many hours I spend in my studio every day, yeah.
Yeah.
Fish took me, Fish, by the way, is prison slang for a new inmate, which is how I came up with the title for my first book. Fish took me 4 years from start till publication day, but it really took me a lifetime to be able to write that book. Many, many years of therapy and recovery. And, you know, as I mentioned to you earlier today when we spoke, you know, for me, the writing Fish was kind of like being in therapy on steroids, because it really forced me to go back there and be in those places again and re-experience the feelings and report back from those places. I was learning how to write along the way as well, and they say for first-time writers, it takes between 3 and 5 years to get your first book out. Took me 4, so I'm right smack in the middle. They say that, you know, the second book comes faster. I hope that's the case. I'd love to see my second book out at some point next year.
Well, thanks very much for having the courage to write that and speak out, and I really appreciate it.
Emily, thank you so much for having me on your show and giving me an opportunity to tell your listeners about this issue and about my book.
Well, thanks again.
Okay, have a great day.
You too. We've been speaking with TJ Parso. He's the author of the book Fish, a memoir of a boy in a man's prison. And you can find more about him and his work at tjparsell.com.